thank you for being here. And what I thought to convey is why we are so interested in neutrinos, and how comes that people with so many different interests are actually here working on neutrino physics. So there are particle physicists who are interested in straight accelerator physics and so on. And there are particle there are people working in astroparticle physics, in astrophysics and cosmology in particular. So I thought to do an introduction, which would be, I'm sure, very elementary for all my particle colleagues, who are welcome to ask whatever at the end. But I hope everybody else will ask things in the middle. So I'm going to make a rather detailed outline, because I'm not sure if I am going to get to the end, and then we can choose a few things to go through. So first of all, I will start with some history. But very brief, and I will say why the birth date of the neutrino is December 4th, 1930, actually. So we can celebrate neutrino's birthday. At least the concept of the neutrino. I will point out that it is the first particle, and we hope there will be others, detected via missing energy. We do this now. Missing energy. We're looking now at the LHC for dark matter particles with techniques that are similar. But this is maybe the only one that we have discovered so far, so missing energy. Now I will say why neutrinos are important in particle physics. And this is because neutrinos, of all the particles that are included in the standard model of elementary particles, the standard model of elementary particles is the most complete theory we have. Actually, model is a misnomer. It comes because of historical reasons of fundamental interactions. You have seen the completion of the standard model with the discovery of the Higgs particle about 2 years ago at the LHC. However, of all the particles in the standard model, neutrinos are the only ones whose properties, the properties we know, imply physics beyond the standard model. Imply physics beyond the standard model. And this is because in the standard model, neutrinos are strictly massless. And instead, we have measured two delta m squared. Okay, so we have measured two different delta m squared. So m1 squared minus m2 squared. And I will explain how we measure that, and then m2 squared minus 3 squared. So this is delta m squared solar. We first discovered it with neutrinos coming from the sun, and then delta m squared atmospheric. So there are two different delta m squared, which implies three neutrinos, three different neutrino masses. And so this implies that at least two of them must be massive. So this is not included in the standard model. And so we need some modification of the standard model. The modification might be trivial, just including, for example, a right-handed neutrinos, which we call sterile, following a paper of Bruno Pontecorvo, which I actually copied for this occasion. And I will read a little bit of it. It could be as simple as that. It could be a very extensive modification, but we don't know exactly in which direction it will go. But this is the only particle in the standard model that we know of that implies that there has to be some modification to the normal of elementary particles. I think this is very fundamental. And there are really very fundamental things. So, how do we generate? Why neutrinos are different from zero? This is what I said. But also, the masses of neutrinos are much smaller than the masses of all the other particles we know. For example, much smaller than the mass of the electron. We don't know that. We have measured now also mixing angle. The properties seem to be quite different for all the masses and mixings between. Mixings, I will explain what mixings are. My mixings are different from those of quarks. And we don't know even if a fundamental particles, fundamental fermion particles, can be Majorana particles. The neutrino is the only one that can be a Majorana fermion. I'm sure in solid state you have also Majorana excitation, Majorana fermion. So they are self-conjugate. In this case, a Majorana, so a Majorana fermion comes, the name comes from Ettore Majorana. Majorana fermion is its own antiparticle. And we know, for example, electrons and positrons and all other particles have, all other fermions have a different a particle and antiparticle. Although we know of bosons that are their own antiparticles and some that are, some that are not. So for example, the neutron is neutral, so it doesn't carry a charge, could be its own antiparticle, could coincide, charge zero, but it is not, because it, well, we don't know if baryon number, it carries baryon number two, but also, for example, the magnetic moment is different. And so it has some properties that actually can distinguish the neutron from the antineutron. And we don't know if neutrinos could be Majorana or not. So this is fundamental issue that will be defined experimentally, probably with the neutrino-less double decay. Okay. Now, so this is neutrinos in particle physics, but why cosmology and astrophysics? Well, neutrinos in astrophysics, why are they so important? Well, neutrinos have only weak interactions. So they are like neutrinos in some respect, but chargeless, no charge. Charge neutrons. So neutrinos have only weak interactions. They have a very small cross section. They don't interact much. And so they escape from sources. So they can tell us directly the inside. We can view through neutrinos the inside of the sources. They escape from sources, and they come, they point to the sources, even at cosmological distances. So the universe is transparent to neutrinos. It is not transparent to photons, actually. Photons interact on the background photons. They produce E plus minus, or E plus minus, or B plus minus, whatever. They interact with cosmic macro or background radiation. They interact with the infrared and the visible light. They interact with the radio at very high energy. So we can see up to cosmological distances with neutrinos, we can see sources via neutrinos that we cannot observe in any other way. And moreover, they escape from the source. So for example, we can see the interior of the Earth. So they escape from the Earth, and geoneutrinos, as they are called, will tell us of how a very important source of heat on Earth that allows us to survive, right? This is what keeps the continents moving and plate tectonics and so on. This is heat that is generated through radioactive decays. And we don't know exactly in which form they are generated, from where. Please, go ahead.
Is there any evidence that neutrinos have gravitational interaction?
No, I don't think so.
Yes, there is.
What? Yeah, but that's why. So, what are the neutrinos going
to do? The effects of gravity have the consequence that the photons. Where are you, Jim? The photons that came from supernova 1987A were delayed in their arrival here by something of the order of a week or a month, something of that order.
Yeah, you're right.
If the neutrinos had not had gravitational interactions on their way here, they would have anticipated the photons by something of that order, and they did no such thing. Hence the evidence.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's fine. So from Earth, from the Sun. So we have seen neutrinos from the Sun. We have been seeing them since 1968, actually. Ray Davis has seen them in a very big pool of cleaning liquid. From other stars, and for example, also from four collapse supernovas, supernova type 2, they are called. And we have observed one, which is the supernova 1987A. It's the only supernova that we have observed in neutrinos. And then, of course, AGNs and active galactic nuclei and other sources of very, very powerful support sources, of course, emit neutrinos too. Finally, neutrinos in cosmology. Why are neutrinos important in the early universe? In the early universe, neutrinos are in equilibrium, in thermal equilibrium. Thermal equilibrium. And the, a temperature, which is about the order of 1 MeV, and this corresponds to a time, which is about 1 second. And the number of neutrinos that remain from that time are about 340 per centimeter. Now, we should compare this. This is the cosmic neutrino background. This cosmic neutrino background is comparable to CMB, cosmic microwave background radiation, which actually comes from much later. It comes from the moment the temperature is about a fraction, 0.2 electron volts, and the time is about 370,000 years, so much later. And the number of these photons, which are the most abundant photons in the universe, is comparable. It's about 410, something like that, per centimeter. So neutrinos, yes?
Sorry, on this note, how is the number for the cosmic neutrino background known, given that they can't detect them?
They're calculated.
Back
yes. In fact, they could be different, and this is what we expect in the standard model. Yes. So this is what we expect. If there are no, you can compute with the thermodynamics in the early universe. If there is no not very large lepton asymmetry, this is with negligible lepton asymmetry. Otherwise, if the lepton asymmetry is much larger, then you could remain with many more of them, and then you will see them because you would see them. Because, of course, this neutrino background, which is so abundant, so neutrinos are the most abundant particles in the universe, except for photons, not CMB photons. So, and this background is so important that actually it affects, so this background affects, affects Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which happens approximately at the same time. Actually, it affects the beta equilibrium, Big Bang, the number. So in Big Bang, the lightest nuclei are formed. This is helium-4, deuterium, a little bit of deuterium remains, and lithium-7. And as afterwards, all the rest is in stars up to iron, and then all the rest, we don't know exactly where it is. It could be in supernovas, the heavier ones. So it affects BBN, it affects CNB, and therefore, from CNB and the larger scale structure of the universe. Larger scale structure of the universe. We have bounds on the amount, possible amount of neutrino species at the moment CNB, and then afterwards larger scale structure happens, and also on the sum of the neutrinos.
It might be argued that the CNB has indirectly confirmed the presence of those neutrinos.
Exactly, right.
Because of the contribution to the energy density at the time the CNB was formed.
In fact, it has also, the range that it has, it's larger than zero. So it has a minimum and a maximum. So in effect, it is about 3. I think I have it someplace. I'll save later when I get there. So it could affect other things that I'm not going to mention, like matter-antimatter asymmetry. I think Boris mentioned that earlier on in his seminar. But it could affect, so you could generate a lepton asymmetry that afterwards is transformed into a baryon asymmetry at the very early. I'm not going to mention that unless there is a question about that. So so let me start now with this discussion, and I hope you will ask me questions. How was this particle proposed? Well, the issue is the following: beta decay. Beta decay, alpha, beta, gamma rays were studied since the 1800s. No? Beta rays are electrons, and we still call beta decay. So beta decay is the decay of, in a nucleus, one has the neutron. Yeah? The neutron then becomes a proton, right? And so it emits an electron. So the neutron goes to a proton plus an electron. But of course, if that would be all, then the energy of the electron will be entirely fixed, will be the difference in mass between the parent nucleus and the daughter nucleus. That has to be positive, because otherwise the beta decay doesn't happen. So the spectrum would have been, if this is the energy of the electron and this is the number of electrons, the intensity, right? It should have been just one at the Q value, which is the difference between these two masses. Should have been a delta function. That is not what was measured. James Chadwick measured that in 1914, and actually it is a continuous something like this that has an end point there, but it has the rest too. So here is the, I made a copy, now you can get everything on the internet, of the original letter. This is the 1930 letter, it's very peculiar, of Wolfgang Pauli to dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen. It was in a conference, December 4, 1930, and says, I have hit upon a desperate remedy. It was the time in which inventing a particle was a big deal, right? to save the conservation of energy, essentially, because otherwise this would indicate that there was no conservation of energy. And it is the possibility that in the nuclei there could exist electrically neutral particles, which I will call neutrons, that have a spin 1/2, and so on. And the mass of these neutrons should be of the same order of magnitude of the electron mass, and in any event, not larger than 0.01 of the proton mass. So he called this particle neutron. Now the actual neutron, the neutron that is almost degenerate with a proton, was discovered in 1932. And so Enrico Fermi, who was obviously Italian, decided to make a difference between these two particles because this paper didn't make a difference between the two, the component of the nucleus and this particle that is emitted in beta decay. And since this one is much lighter, right, he decided to call it neutrino, which in Italian means just little neutron. So it's a neutrino, so there is a neutrino. Now, what is really interesting in this letter is that this guy had his priorities straight. He says, unfortunately, I cannot personally appear in Tübingen where this conference happened, since I am indispensable here in Zurich because of a ball in the night from December 6 to 7. Priorities is very important. He had a ball. So, in modern terms, we would put it actually the protons and neutrons are quarks, and so here you have an up, down, and another down. This is a neutron, and then you have a W, which is a mediator of weak interactions that goes into this electron and then into an electron. Okay, this is the, and then it goes, this goes into another core. Okay, so this is the modern version of this process, but still there they are. Now, it took a long time for this particle to be actually detected, namely producing something, not emitting energy, but actually producing something somewhere else. And that was done in 1953. This actually was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1995 for this measurement. But this is not the end, the story. So here you have that the W particle goes into E and UE, but of course these are not the only leptons. In 1954, there was a heavier electron, right, which is called the muon, that was discovered. And that was the first particle of the second generation. So in our standard model of elementary particles, we have two copies of each of the particles of the first generation. And so this is the second generation. And again, the new mu corresponding to this mu was discovered, which was proven to be different than the neutrino electron. And this was, again, another Nobel Prize winning discovery. This was 1988 Nobel Prize. And then in 1977, oh, another one, still another heavier one. Again, the first particle of the third generation. And the neutrino tau was only actually detected in the year 2000 at Fermilab. So here we have the three neutrinos that correspond to the three generations. So we have down, range, top, bottom, and neutrino, neutron, and electron, neutrino, mu, and mu, neutrino, tau. These are the three generations when we know that there cannot be, at least light generations cannot be. At LEP, we have measured the number of in the width, we have LEP produced many millions of Z zeros, which are the other neutron mediators of weak interactions. And actually, the width of this resonance is the width of resonance indicates that actually there cannot be the number of neutrinos with the mass of the neutrino that can be produced in the Z. So Z can go into two neutrinos. If the mass of the neutrino is smaller than the mass of the Z over 2, which is about 50 GeV, something like that, the number of neutrinos is less than 3. So we know that there are three generations of these light ones and going more. Now,
presumably less than or equal to 3.
Huh?
Less than or equal to 3.
Yeah, actually. That is true. It's less than three. Now, it is 2.9 something. So
Graciela, what is the evidence for that? Is that from...
From the width of the Z, because of course this is an invisible decay modes of the Z. Okay, the width of the Z, 2.9. Now, this in the standard model, there is a difference between chiralities. So I'm not going to talk about quarks anymore. They have a strong interaction. I'm going to talk about leptons. Leptons we have all these names that meant originally something else. Lepton comes from light, but now it means only things that, particles that do not experience strong interactions, right? So here, these are left-handed particles. These are left chiralities. Well, chiralities and ellicities coincide when particles are massless. So an ellicity, left or right, means that the spin has a component plus or minus. It's in the direction or opposed to the direction of motion of the particle. For mass equal to zero, this chirality concept is the same, but in reality, a chirality is a property that is Lorentz invariant. So it corresponds to when you have a fermion, 1 minus gamma 5 over 2. So you have a fermion, the left-handed component of the fermion is 1 minus gamma 5 over 2. The right-handed component of the fermion is 1 plus gamma 5 over 2. We are all familiar with the gammas, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 4, gamma 5, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma whatever. So this is a projector. It's idempotent, and actually it breaks down any Dirac fermion in this case as F less less. Now, what happened? These are SU2 doublets, and that's why I put it like that. The standard model has the symmetry SU2 left cross a U1, something that's called a hypercharge, plus SU3 color. Color is a strong interaction. SU2 are, these are doublets. And the right-handed chiralities instead don't have an SU2 charge. So they are singlets. So here I will have E right, mu right, and tau right. And in the standard model, the neutrinos right are not present. Neutrinos right would be a very strange beast, because actually they would be completely singlets of all interactions. They don't carry, of course, strong interactions, but they don't carry any charge, electric charge, or any charge of U1. So they are singlets, complete singlets. In the standard model, they are not there. And they are not put there because the way in which masses are generated involve having a boson that is also a doublet, is the Higgs boson. And from the coupling of the doublet with the doublet to make a singlet and multiply with another singlet, we get the mass terms. For example, for the electron, so we get the mass of the electron, new electron left bar, electron right. This is the type, this is a Dirac mass. Dirac mass term. And the electron left and the electron right are separate particles, completely independent particles. This mass in the standard model comes from an arbitrary coupling constant multiplied by the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field. So Higgs field gives the mass. But not having the neutrinos right prevents from having the only type of masses that are included in the standard model. Now, we know now that neutrinos have mass. And this is an issue It comes from oscillations. And so let me explain why oscillations. And I think the time passes very fast. So let us see. We'll try to explain how. The difference in neutrino mass is usually much smaller than the energy of the neutrinos carry. And so when you produce a neutrino, for example, when you produce a neutrino through interaction, you're actually producing a neutrino E or a neutrino mu or a neutrino tau. These are interaction eigenstates. Each of these interaction eigenstates is a certain superposition of mass eigenstates. So this is mu mu. And then assume that I have just two flavors. This is easier with two. In reality, there are three, and there are many complications. But this is, let me say that there are two. So mu mu is cosine of an angle mu 1 plus sine of an angle mu 2. And so mu e is minus sine mu 1 plus cosine mu 2. Cosine of theta mu 2. So, so they are mixed. So this neutrino, mu, is of course a certain combination, as I said, of this at the beginning. So new mu, this new mu at the beginning, is, as I said, cosine theta mu 1 plus sine theta mu 2. But we know that in quantum mechanics, this state will propagate with its energy, and this state will propagate with its energy. And the energy is slightly different because the masses are slightly different. So the energy is approximately the momentum, and we call it P. Okay, we call it, I'm calling the momentum P. The magnitude, the modulus P, so is approximately P plus the mass squared over P, actually over 2P. Mm-hmm. And E2 will be P, let me just call it P, plus M2 squared over 2P. So you know very well, even if you overlap two frequencies in a guitar, for example, something like that, are beats. So in this case, the frequency is the frequency of this beat would be the difference between the energies. And so the difference between the energies depends on delta m squared, so the difference in m squared over 2p. This is where the delta m squared enters. And so actually, the oscillation length is 2 pi over delta E. So the oscillation length is 2.47. If you pick up the energy in GVs, the delta M squared measured in electron volt squared, and then the distance in kilometers. And now it comes something that is absolutely amazing. The amazing thing is that there is a delta M squared, so that this oscillation length is of the size of the radius of the Earth. And so when neutrinos mu coming from different directions got into Kamiokande, very big pool, very big tank of water, and it detected neutrino mu, then it saw that part of this neutrino mu disappeared into something else. And this is simply because of this coincidence. So the radius of the Earth is 6,400 kilometers. So here you put, 10 to the 3 kilometers. That means that delta m squared, to have maximal effect, delta m squared is of order 10 to the minus 3 electron volt squared, lo and behold, this is actually one of the values. So you believe in coincidence, right? So why we have total eclipses of the sun? Because the moon is in the right position and with the right size, right? There's no... So how is that we were able to discover these oscillations that in vacuum, okay, delta atmospheric? Actually, there is a number that is two here, delta atmospheric. Simply because of this coincidence. It's actually absolutely amazing that this is so. For neutrinos that are coming from the sun, the situation is more interesting because there are matter effects. So neutrinos, when they traverse a dense medium, like in the sun, relatively dense medium, like in the sun, they suffer diffraction, you know, like light passing through a diffractive medium is the same thing. And so it is a bit more complicated. But then there is another delta m squared. Again, since 1968, there have been a solar neutrino problem. It took like 40 years to 30 years to actually be solved. And it was that actually less neutrinos were arriving from the sun, okay, than what this was predicted by the best solar models of the time. And it was simply because they were oscillating into something else, neutrino muons and so on. So delta m squared solar is 10 to the minus 5. It's of order 10 to the minus 5. It's 7, 10 to the minus 5. Electron volt squared. So you see that with this, we can say that if one of them is massless or much smaller than the other, you get that at least two of the neutrinos have a mass which are larger than 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Now there are other limits that are probably the best limits come from CMB and large scale structure, which is about 1 electron volt. The sum of the neutrino masses and so on. But still, we haven't measured the masses themselves. So we don't know the hierarchy. Namely, if these two that seem to be more degenerate, more closer in mass, are the lower ones. So if this is the mass, if we have something like this, or if this is the mass going up, if we have something like that.
Because of that thing, people have problems.
Thank you. So we do not know the masses themselves. Okay. So if this is the mass, we do not know if this is delta M solar, and this is then delta M atmospheric, or vice versa, something like this. So these are two possibilities that we would like to find out, actually. Also, we don't know what are the masses. We see only in delta M square. Okay, so let me see. So having that this in mind, now there are a few, by the way, these were initially measured by Ray Davis in this mine. In the Homestake mine here in the US, and then by Kamioka in Japan. But of course, they were actually confirmed in many other terrestrial experiments. You see that actually you can measure the same delta M square and also the same mixing angle if you have the right energy and the right length. So by changing the length and the energy accordingly, you can test exactly the same delta M squared. So this has been measured with, for example, nu mu over nu tau, fluorine, gadolinium in super Kamiokande, in snow in Borexino, nu e disappearance in Kam land in Japan. Atmospheric neutrinos and new antineutrinos disappear most likely to new tau, super K, and minos, and so on and so forth. There have been about maybe 15 different experiments that have been measured to have been done to confirm this. Yes.
Is there a Is there an equivalent mixing for the electrons into muons?
Well, yes, there are three atoms mixed together. This is, of course, a simple argument in which I'm mixing two. But if you see the lecture notes of Boris, he uses actually the matrices, which are three by three matrices of mixing. So nu in, nu mu, nu tau are mixed to three, nu one, nu two,
nu three. But also the electron, the muon, and the tau are mixing in the same way?
No, electron, muon, and tau are defined to be mass eigenstates, and therefore we put all the mixing in the neutrinos. This is an arbitrary thing, but actually, so when you do this, right, what you have is something like that: electron, muon, tau. Okay, this on left. Here you have gamma mu. Here you have W. And W mu, this is vector boson. And here you will have also neutrino, 1, 2, 3. And here you have a mixing, a matrix, right, of mixing. Right? So then we assign this matrix here. So we say that the neutrino electron, the one that couples directly, is the first three. Assume that this is A, B, C. So the neutrino electron is A nu 1 plus B nu 2 plus C nu 3. So we assign this in this way. We do the same thing, actually, for the quarks. This is a matter of convention. OK, so all this implies that neutrinos are massive, and there is physics beyond the standard model. Physics can be very complicated. Now, if we have a neutrino, an estelar neutrino, the estelar neutrino, and this is where I wanted to read a few lines. The name estelar for the neutrino, right, comes from a paper of Bruno Pontecorvo, the person who chose, some people say the vector, but actually chose to go to live in Russia after the Second World War. And he's an Italian, Bruno Pontecorvo. And he says, this paper is absolutely amazing. I mean, it was done in 1968, when the beginning of all this. He proposes, actually, to use oscillation, neutrino oscillations. And if you read it, this is the first time I do because of this lecture, actually, it contains the whole program of research that has been carrying on so far. It has all the ideas here. It's absolutely amazing. And in one of them, it says that due to oscillations, these neutrinos could potentially convert active particles into particles that are, from the point of view of the ordinary weak interaction, sterile. And this is where sterile neutrinos, the name comes from. That is practically unobservable since they have the incorrect elicity. I must say that there are hints for a third delta M square. It was first found in an experiment called LSND, and there was another experiment called Mini Boon that has been inconclusive because some of the things that were found agree with LSND and some don't. And so and there are other anomalies, and this would be about delta M square, 1 electron volt square, and a large mixing angle. I didn't explain the mixing angles. The mixing angles, of course, is a whole matrix of mixings, and they look very, very different than the mixing for quarks. This is also an indication that the origin of mass for neutrinos is completely different than the origin of mass for everything else. If there would be a third delta M square, in order to have three independent delta M squares, I have to have four neutrinos. The fourth neutrino cannot be active. I have already mentioned that the Z, the left bound on the number of active neutrinos, tells you that it cannot be active. So it could be an esteral. So this would be an stellar neutrino that has masses of the order of electron volt, and that would be extremely interesting because actually would prove the existence of right-handed neutrino. Now, if the right-handed neutrino exists, but it has a completely different mass, and it can have a completely different mass, if the mass of the stellar neutrino could be a keV, then there could be more than one stellar neutrino. Could be 2, 3, 4, 5, many more, right? So one of them, if one of them could have one keV, then it could be a good dark matter candidate. This is a good dark matter candidate. It is warm instead of cold. So many other particles that are heavier or they are non-relativistic much earlier would be are cold. I can explain what warm means, but it's a different kind of dark matter candidate. It's a very interesting dark matter candidate. And there could have been found an indication for it. Of course, this is in a state of flux, so it may not be. But this neutrino, this is the real neutrino. So here you have a diagram. It would go into, this is, for example, electron or a charged lepton. And a photon could be emitted from here, or from here, the W is charged. And this is another neutrino, light neutrino. So mu s can decay into a photon and another light neutrino. If this is so, then the photon, the energy of the photon, this is a two-body decay, would be the mass of the neutrino over 2. And keV photons are X-ray photons, and there are X-ray satellites, okay, X-ray telescopes putting satellites. And recently, this year, there have been two independent collaborations that have found an indication of a 3.5 keV line coming apparently from dark matter. One was in the Andromeda galaxy, the other was from dwarf galaxies and also from galaxy clusters, some indication, 3.5 keV line. If this stays, then this would mean that there is a stellar neutrino of 7 keV, and it would be a very good candidate for dark matter, but of course we don't know. So I don't think I have time to go to all of the things that I wanted to mention. That's why I did a very, but I can pick up one more and talk about 5 minutes from that. What is that you would prefer? Physics, cosmology? Do you have any preference?
Why don't you tell us what you're most interested in?
Well, I'm mostly interested in dark matter. That's the point. Yes, but so stellar neutrinos could be one of those. But there are many other things. I think that maybe I would like to mention some of the things that actually other people are doing, because this is extremely interesting. For example, general neutrinos, as I said, were discovered about 3 years ago. The first ones were measured in 2010. There was another measurement, Porrexino, in the Gran Sasso laboratory, and also Kamland in Japan. So this is very interesting. There are about 100 of these general neutrinos measured so far. The sun, I'm not going to mention. By the way, the discovery of neutrinos from the sun and neutrinos from supernova 1987 was actually the was so the, this discovery was awarded the Nobel the 2002 Nobel Prize. And this was for initiating neutrino astronomy. As you see, the fact that having neutrinos from the sun and having neutrinos from supernova and so on, having atmospheric neutrinos, actually, in Super Kamiokande and so on. These are the same people, Super Kamiokande and Ray Davies were the ones that actually were given the Nobel Prize. That hasn't arisen, hasn't been given. So the Nobel Prize for having seen neutrino masses hasn't been awarded for neutrino oscillations. I would like to say maybe something about supernova neutrinos. So in core collapse supernova neutrinos, and I will not write anything, I'll just talk. So in stars, one can produce, stars can produce up to iron. So namely from hydrogen, you go to helium, from helium, you go to, I don't know, I think oxygen and then silicon and then iron. Iron is a stable, you cannot really, you don't have enough energy, it's very stable, you don't have enough energy in stars to produce something heavier than iron. So I don't know if you have any gold on you or something like that. This gold has to be produced somewhere else. And one of the sites is precisely supernovas, in the supernova explosion. So when the core of a star gets larger, the iron core gets larger than a certain mass, it's about 1.5 solar masses, then it cannot withstand the gravitational pressure. So this is an inert core. There's nothing burning inside. And so it just collapses. And it collapses up to a neutron star. Namely, all the protons and electrons come together, and they produce neutrons, and of course neutrinos. There is a very big burst of neutrinos. And then it starts collapsing. The whole star collapses, too. And then the collapse is halted. So there is a bounce, right? It's like a ball that gets to a hard surface and bounces back. And this bounce produces a shock wave that is supposed to produce the explosion of a supernova. Now, 99% of the energy of a supernova explosion goes into neutrinos. 1% goes in everything else. This 1% is enough for the supernova to be the brightest, even brightest than the galaxy that hosts it for some time, right? For example, the supernova 1987A happened in the Magellanic Cloud, which is an irregular galaxy orbiting the Milky Way. 99% of the energy goes into that. So you can imagine that in slight changes in the neutrino physics have an enormous impact. So, for example, still now in the best three-dimensional supernovas simulations of supernova explosions, supernovas don't explode. What happens is that this bounce, the shock wave, loses energy, dissociating nuclei and so on and so forth, loses energy, and at the end, it doesn't get to expel all the mantle. But, for example, you know, neutrino oscillations could help in depositing energy. So, for example, assume that you produce in the core, where they're very hot, very, very energetic, sterile neutrinos that become, that escape, therefore, from the core because they don't interact and become interacting neutrinos, neutrino electrons, just behind the shock. They energize the shock and they could help neutrinos explode, and supernovas explode. Also, this rapid neutrino capture processes can be changed by the neutrino physics. So the amount, the relative amount of different nuclei that are produced in that setting. There are other possible sites. It's not known if you actually use that site. And then finally, pulsar kicks. Pulsars, so some of these neutrino, the cores become neutrino, can become neutron stars. Some of these neutron stars would be really funny. Neutron stars, some of these neutron stars have very large magnetic fields. They produce jets, and some of these jets, they rotate, and some of these jets get point in the direction of the Earth, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, and this is, so they are pulses, huh? They are pulses of radiation, so these are pulsars, rapidly rotating neutron stars. pulses have been measured, and many of them are escaping from the disk where they were located at very high velocities. Some of them, 15% of them or so, have velocities larger than 1,000 kilometers per second, which is quite a bit. The velocity of the sun around the galaxy is 220 kilometers per second, 1,000. There are a few that have up to 1,600 kilometers per second. And again, neutrino oscillations could produce a pulsar kick that would produce enough energy, enough momentum, to give this enormous kick to the neutron. So how it would happen, they have large magnetic fields. Of course, the large magnetic fields don't affect the neutrinos in themselves. They have, if at all, they have very small magnetic fields. But they would magnetize or orient some of the electrons and some of the nucleons. And electrons, nucleons, interacting with neutrinos have an asymmetric emission of neutrinos. So there will be more neutrinos emitted on one side than on the other. So assume that part of those are stellar neutrinos and they escape. They could give a very nice kick just with 1% of the energy that goes into neutrinos. So you can imagine there is an enormous amount of research that can be done in all of this. And, well, I hope I have given just a little hint and a little show of this enormous amount of physics. And I don't know if there are questions from anywhere. Yes.
Do you have other candidates for dark matter?
Oh yeah, there are many other candidates for dark matter in physics beyond the standard model. We don't even know if dark matter consists of particles. Huh? However, many extensions of the standard model contain particles that could be dark matter. Most of them are cold dark matter. So most of the dark matter in the universe we know, because of large scale structure arguments, must be either cold or warm. Cannot be really hot. Neutrinos would be hot. So neutrinos can only be a little bit. But so we have many candidates. Most of them are cold. Like for example, there's an enormous amount of new particles that are in typically, for example, supersymmetric extensions of the standard model. They are models in which you have many, many particles.
So let me refine my question. If supersymmetry is not observed, then you have
it doesn't matter. There are so many more models. You can invent an enormous amount of models. Many of them would or would not have something to predict at the LHC. You can have an enormous amount of models that have been explored in recent years just to account for hints of dark matter. There have been hints of dark matter in direct detection, indirect detection, and so on. It's an enormous field.
So what's your hint of your research? You work on dark matter and you believe like the neutrinos could be responsible for them, but then you tell us they are a bit too hot?
No, they are not a bit too hot. No, not a bit too hot. It could be welcome that they are a bit hot. And this is because warm dark matter candidates are becoming non-relativistic at the moment galaxies start forming. And so with cold candidates, one produces very small structures, which then coalesce and become bigger and bigger. With warm dark matter, one does not produce structures that are smaller than the cores of dwarf galaxies. And that could, for example, explain why dwarf galaxies have cores. They seem to have cores instead of having cusps and profile in their dark matter density profile. They could also suppress, there is a problem that is called too big to fail. Physicists that are very powerful people. You remember the banks that are too big to fail. These are substructures. So with cold dark matter, one tends to produce many, many substructures that are too big not to have produced stars in them, and therefore they should be observable, and they are not. But of course, all these arguments are in flux, as I said. So it could be that having a candidate that is warm is welcome, actually. It's a very interesting type of candidate.
Why is this neutrino called sterile? It seems like it interacts via weak interaction?
It interacts via mixing, actually. So this is something that has to interact via mixing. Right? So this interacts with the mixing. So in the mass eigenstates, so the mass eigenstate neutrino sterile will consist of neutrino right plus a little bit of the light neutrinos, which are interacting. Right? So here you have this little epsilon. And then, so the mass eigenstate is an admixture of something that is completely sterile, a little bit. So the only thing that you have is an interaction via the mass mixing, actually.
And that's why it doesn't go into that lift, or is that?
Right. It does. It's not produced. It's mostly neutrino. Right. Exactly. What would contribute to the width is so there is some wiggle room. There is plus minus something, right? So if it is small enough, it wouldn't contribute. As a full neutrino, but a full channel of decay for the Z, right?
Wouldn't one be happier with a dark matter that only interacted via gravity rather than something?
I would be very unhappy, but it is a possibility. And it is frighteningly simple, even with models of dark matter. To produce dark matter candidates that would not be detectable because they interact very, very lightly, so practically they would only be detectable.
Wouldn't it solve certain big problems more easily? I mean,
The fact that neutrinos are warm or cold only affect the equation of a state, essentially. It affects the way in which they escape from initial inhomogeneities or not. So if they are hot, or while they are relativistic, particles escape. So while they escape, these inhomogeneities are erased. And then at some point when they become non-relativistic, they stay and they can be affected by gravity. But this is only gravity. And the velocity that it has, the free streaming length, which is called. So it doesn't affect, these particles could have no interaction whatsoever and still be warm or cold. But we don't know. This dark matter probably has been with us for 80 years, since Zwicky first proposed this in 1930s. And 1930s, yes. And in these 8 years, we have something like restricted the potential mass of the dark matter particles by something like 80 or 90 orders of magnitude, from 10 to the minus 7 solar masses, which is a tenth of the mass of the Earth, to about maybe 10 to the minus 31, or it could be even less. The only thing is 10 to the minus 31 GeV. We have some candidates, but it could be even smaller. So we don't know. It could be, for example, black holes, primordial black holes. But there are a few things that you can imagine that could be produced in this very large amounts. But even if it is a dark matter particle, it could be entirely due to a dark sector. Now we have plenty of models with dark sectors and interact with our world only due to gravitational interactions, in which case we are not going to detect them. But you know, in neutrino physics is a good example of why or in which way we are doing dark matter searches. There were many searches for masses and mixing angles of neutrinos in the completely wrong ranges. Some of my experimental colleagues spend 20 years of their life, we theorists are happy with everything, but experimental colleagues, once they engage in it, it's 20 years of their life, right? Measuring, do you remember donuts? I don't remember now. There were many experiments at CERN, Fermilab, looking for neutrinos, and they completely, so the only thing that they got was, you know, bounce. It's not here, it's not there, it's not there. And then all of a sudden, boop, the neutrinos came up. And you know, these neutrinos came up, you know, just because they were there. And in reality, the Superchemio Grande, which made all this amount of physics in neutrino physics and so on, was created to measure proton decay. To try to measure proton decay. We should forget about that. And then all of a sudden, this comes. So we know with dark matter, we are looking for dark matter where we can look. You know this joke of the lamppost that I'm looking here because for my key because there is light and I don't know where it was, but you know here I can look at. And we are doing it, I think, because the payoff is so great. The payoff wouldn't be so astonishingly great if you find something. Then you wouldn't spend all this money and effort in doing that. But the payoff is enormous. So it's big payoff physics and big risk.
Okay, before we end, I neglected to mention there will be a wine and cheese today at 5 p.m. where we can all discuss neutrinos. And Graciela, I hope, will be there.
Yes, sir.